This is a very serious podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Splantniks. I'm your host, Claire Walker. I'm an independent author, and I'm joined by my co-host and daughter, Hannah Kubiak, a theater professional, author, and artist who I raised to be a total nerd. Today is our June Book Club episode, and we'll be discussing Ray Bradbury's novel, Fahrenheit 451. Stay tuned.
Bye.
Welcome to Splantniks, the Society for the Preservation of Literature, the Arts, Numinosity, Culture, Humor, Nerdiness, Inspiration, Creativity, and Storytelling.
Now, Ray Bradbury is described as a fantasy, science fiction, horror, and mystery writer. He's definitely a multi-genre author, and my copy of the 1971 paperback of Fahrenheit 451 describes him as the finest living American fantasist. That paperback copy was published in 1971. Ray Bradbury is no longer with us. He passed away in 2012. He was born in actually suburban Chicago, right around here in the suburban Chicago. He and his family moved to Los Angeles in 1934 when he was 14. Now he did, like I said, he wrote in multiple genres, but he's famous for three main science fiction novels. The first is called The Martian Chronicles, published in 1950. The Illustrated Man, 1951, and Fahrenheit 451, published as a book in 1953, but it originally appeared as a short story in Galaxy Science Fiction magazine in 1950. The title of that short story was The Fireman. So Bradbury expanded it into a book, and it was published in 1953. So Bradbury was definitely an avid reader of those science fiction pulp magazines from the 20s and 30s, especially Astounding Science Fiction. And he credits Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, Theodore Sturgeon, H.G. Wells, Jules Verne as his greatest influences. He was also extremely well-read in literature and poetry, which you can tell by reading Fahrenheit 451. There's a number of references to famous works. And he credits his experience and exposure to great literature and poetry with what many of his admirers call his very lyrical prose style. Mm. You remember last week we were talking about Isaac Asimov, and yeah. I was saying how Isaac Asimov is just a very, very plain, just almost nondescript, very, very simple prose, mm-hmm. not flowery at all.
Would you describe him maybe as like the Hemingway of science fiction?
Sure. Yeah. Very, very just quick and to the point. He wasn't interested in trying to write flowery language, Asimov. And I appreciate that about him because his writing is very clear. Bradbury is a little bit different, especially in this book here. The prose style of Fahrenheit 451 is really out there. I mean, it's almost surreal. You know, some of his passages, it's very, very interesting book. It's in a way, it's fortunate that the book is rather short. It's only 147 pages, my edition of it anyway, because too much surrealism, you can have too much of a good thing. You know, that extremely lyrical, fanciful prose can be a little hard to read over thousands of pages. But, you know, this was a good, kind of like eating just a couple pieces of fine chocolate, you know, from a box, reading this book. Really, really impressed with the language and the use of English here and imagery and the way he just creates such an interesting mood with his prose. So Fahrenheit 451 is a book about it's a dystopia. It's a dystopic future in which books are banned and people zone out on electronic media.
That's why I chose this book, actually, because last time I read it, like a year ago, I read it, and it kind of frightened me.
Oh, yeah?
So yeah. I think that it's definitely relevant today. I definitely have been trying to read more since then. Mm. I've been trying to experience life, you know, to the fullest. I've been trying to have thoughts about things instead of being lazy and just not having opinions, you know.
Interesting.
So, yeah, well, my personality, I'm very, very phlegmatic and very go with the flow. Don't rock the boat. Just drift along, dude.
So, yeah, it was interesting. When I was preparing my my course in popular fiction that I taught at the community college around here, I came across this quote from Bradbury describing Fahrenheit 451. He didn't realize how prescient he was in writing this book. He was in Beverly Hills and he describes this incident. He says, this quote, let me just give you where this quote is from. It's from a book by Kingsley Amis, A-M-I-S, 1960 book. And the book is called New Maps of Hell, A Survey of Science Fiction.
This is going to be good, I can tell.
New Maps of Hell, A Survey of Science Fiction by Kingsley Amis, 1960. So Bradbury says this, in writing the short novel Fahrenheit 451, I thought I was describing a world that might evolve in 4 or 5 decades. But only a few weeks ago, in Beverly Hills one night, a husband and wife passed me walking their dog. I stood staring after them, absolutely stunned. The woman held in one hand a small, cigarette-packaged-sized radio, its antenna quivering. From this sprang tiny copper wires which ended in a dainty cone plugged into her right ear. There she was, oblivious to man and dog, listening to far winds and whispers and soap opera cries, sleepwalking, helped up and down curbs by a husband who might just as well not have been there. This was not fiction. So... And, you know, he must have, this must have been very formative because it's kind of what the relationship of the main character, Guy Montag, is to his wife, Mildred. He might as well not even been there, even though one of the opening scenes of the book, he literally saves her life because she accidentally nearly commits suicide by,
she took too many pills.
Took too many pills because she wasn't paying attention to how many she had taken. Evidently. That's the impression. She's just popping pills, you know, sleeping pills. He had to call and have some guys come and pump her stomach and purify her blood. And then he goes, well, why isn't there a doctor here? Well, you guys are not doctors. They were clearly like, just like, they acted like they were plumbers. Right?
Yeah.
Remember that? They come in, they said, oh, you know, we get 9 or 10 of these a night. I was like, what? You know,
oh my gosh.
Common in this dystopia that Ray Bradbury has created, this sort of mind-numbed environment, you know, are these deaths of despair or are these deaths of obliviousness, you know, like just literally taking
just carelessness.
Didn't even realize it. So, so it's interesting. You know, he was describing a world that he thought might evolve in 4 or 5 decades. And within 10 years of his writing the short story, you know, 1960, he's telling Kingsley Amis that he saw basically a scene out of his book.
Wow.
Beverly Hills.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So now let's jump forward 4 or 5 decades. Really, we're in... Well, he wrote the story in 1950. We are now 70 years later.
Yeah.
And we definitely are in a world where, I think the sale and the reading of books might be down compared to a few decades ago, certainly back in those days. And people are zoning out on electronic media, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, even I consider myself an avid reader.
Yeah.
And even I have noticed myself that I'm not reading nearly as much as I used to.
Yeah, no, me neither. I try to read every day, but I still feel like I don't read as much as I used to. When I was a kid, I'd come home from school and I would read a book until dinner time.
Me too. I had the same experience. And I would read a book. I read every night before I went to sleep, and usually it was fiction. You know, I read a lot of stories.
Yeah.
And I would read until I was, tired or, fell asleep or had to force myself to turn off the light so I could get up in the morning. But yeah, reading before bed was a treasured pastime. And in fact, Nanny, my mom, your grandmother, sometimes if we needed some sort of negative consequence for something we had done, no reading before bed tonight. That was what? And that was just like, sliced. That was awful to be told you couldn't read before bed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I miss those days sometimes.
Yeah. But you can have those times again. I mean, I've gotten into reading before bed now again because I really want to get more into reading fiction. And I have, in the past couple years, trying to pick up books.
Well, this book club is partially just to get me to read something, at least a book every month.
That's awesome. Yeah. This is good. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Now tell me about, you told me a little bit about why you wanted to study this book in our book club, because it helped you with your, resolution to want to read.
My generation gets a bad rap about technology. Like, I think it happens with pretty much every generation where they say, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you've never heard of this, you young scamp. What is the youth coming to? Yeah. But maybe it's just because it's my generation, but I feel like we're being hit particularly hard by the sort of like ignorance shaming.
Yes.
And being told like, oh yeah, you millennials with your cell phones glued to your hand, and I hate it because I don't want that to be how we are known and how we're remembered. And I think that this book is easy to read and this book is relevant. This book convinced me to read more and convinced me to think about my screen time and stuff like that. Mm.
Yeah.
And I want more people from my age group, more of my peers, to think this way, to think like I want to read and gather information and form my opinions based on what I've learned, as opposed to based on what people say I should believe, I think we need to learn how to think again, because I find that sometimes I'm like, I don't know what to believe or anything. So I'm just not going to believe anything because I don't want to be wrong. Believing things and making decisions in your life is part of what makes you human and what makes you alive, So here's some of the things that I really enjoyed about, or that stood out to me in Fahrenheit 451. The idea that they do book burning. The firemen, their job now is to go out and burn books. And the book burning, what it causes is suppression of ideas and suppression of change. Because kind of like when we were talking about 1984 in our science fiction episode, if people don't know about the past, they assume that the present has always what life has always been like. So, and you can't learn from the past if you don't know about it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes older generations want to keep their slip-ups and their mistakes secret from the younger generation. Like, the story of the Cristero War in Mexico?
Yes.
That was not taught in school in Mexico.
Right.
Because people were ashamed by that. They didn't want anyone to know about this war.
Yeah. And some people managed to find out about it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It was definitely a dark blot on the history of Mexico in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 Horrible, horrible incident. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, in what I labeled as the inciting incident of this book, is when the protagonist Montag steals a book from a fire. And I'm not sure exactly why he did this. I think maybe because he was disillusioned with his life as a fireman. He just felt like there wasn't any purpose anymore. There was a little girl that he was talking to, like his neighbor, who she got, she and her family were different from other families, and they actually had discussions and they talked about things and they had ideas, and then she was disappeared.
Yes. That had a big impact on him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you describe his stealing of the book at that house that he and the other firemen were sent to burn. Someone said, you know, sounded the alarm that we know about a house with books in it, mm-hmm. and they would send the firemen there, and he went there and he just on an impulse picked up a book and took it.
Yeah. It was almost instinct.
Yeah. But he had been there. He'd been a little bit on that road already, because remember, he had some books already.
Oh, he did. Up. He did have a couple of books.
Yeah. He had been on this road a little bit. So we kind of caught him in the middle of a transformation. So it was,
yeah. When it starts to get more serious, when it's not just, oh, hey, a book, I'm going to take it. And then he's doing it on purpose maybe. But yeah. In this world, mass media replaces literature. There's decreased attention spans. Books are defined as confusing and depressing, and they're burned to protect the peace.
Yeah, and to make sure that people aren't unhappy. Mm-hmm. Books make people, remember when he reads the poem Dover Beach mm-hmm. to his wife's friends, and she just bursts into tears, and they say, mm-hmm. put it away, we don't want to be unhappy, burn that book.
Yeah, yeah. Books make people unhappy.
They throw it in the incinerator. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we can't, so to protect the peace. Well, I don't know. As a person who I really like things being peaceful and nice, and I hate conflict of any kind. This is hard for me because I'm like, okay, if you want peace so badly that you're willing to keep everybody ignorant, is it really peace? Or is it just sort of like a manufactured way of life? Like,
right.
Is it just a right. sort of drugged up society?
Well, it's like, do you remember that line from one of the opening sequences of Rogue One?
Mm-hmm.
Where Krennic flies in there and he lands on Galen Erso's farm,
mm-hmm.
and what does he say? He says the Empire is gonna bring peace to the galaxy,
mm-hmm.
right? And Erso says, what does he say? He says,
okay, wait a second. Mm-hmm. We were on the verge of greatness. We were this close to providing peace and security for the galaxy. And then Erso says, you're confusing peace with terror. And then Krennic says, well, you have to start somewhere.
You have to start somewhere. So terror, yeah. So what you're describing then is the peace that you're describing that's based on ignorance and control of the population. Is that really peace?
Mm-mm.
No, it's a kind of soft terror, isn't it? Because there's mm-hmm. a consequence. Because one of the things about any kind of dystopia is that there is a controlling elite with the power to enforce their version of utopia on everyone else.
Yeah.
You know, and as we know, one man's utopia is another man's, you know, hell on earth, right?
Yep.
So the controlling elite has the power to enforce what they want.
Yeah.
And one of the ways they enforce is by having the firemen go burn collections of books.
Mm-hmm.
They count on the people betraying one another, turning one another in. I mean, that is a classic. In a totalitarian surveillance state.
Kind of like in the SS,
Yeah, or the Stasi, you know, in East Germany, Stasi, and what I imagine it's like in every totalitarian regime we've ever had or still do have.
Mm-hmm.
People turning in one another. So they do that. And then the other thing is they not only have the power to burn all the books and make sure that the information is controlled,
mm-hmm.
they have the power to literally kill you. You know, this thing, the hound,
yep.
which can be fed each person's unique biochemical makeup.
Yep.
And like a sniffing hound, it will go and get you, and then it literally kills you.
Yeah.
And they set that up beautifully in the firehouse by the games that they play, where they set the hound to programmed to find just, you know, mice and rats and stray chickens and cats, you know, that are just mm-hmm. wandering around, and they show how brutal this thing is.
Yeah.
And how how efficient it is at finding its prey and dispatching it immediately. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the book, when Montag is being chased by this thing, then yeah, we know there's a real sense of jeopardy.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So the power to enforce the the situation. And then the other thing that every dystopia needs is some sort of the existence of some sort of resistant underground movement of some kind.
Yeah.
That's
where Faber comes in, right?
That's where Faber comes in. And then at the end of the book where Montag meets the guys around the campfire, and he discovers this whole network of people who have been memorizing books.
Yeah. The exiles. Yeah.
In order to preserve them. It reminded me, Hannah, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but you know, this idea that there are men and women around the world who realize that the culture needs to be preserved, and they do it by memorizing it, because it's not safe to have physical copies of texts around. They memorize it. What's the name of that movie with Denzel Washington? And
The Book of Eli.
Okay, yeah, The Book of Eli.
He has the entire Bible memorized.
Yeah, and so what that movie's about is this man's journey. Yeah. Spoiler alert on The Book of Eli. Fast forward. The Denzel Washington character does is he's on a journey to find this underground resistance enclave where they're preserving the culture, and his job is to go there and recite the Bible to these people so that it can be preserved now for posterity. So in a world of book burning, the idea of being able to memorize entire texts is the only way to preserve it.
Yeah.
Was that clear to you how it was almost like a throwaway line that they had at the end of the book where Montag is talking to the men in the camp about how one of them had realized that everyone has a photographic memory, and it was just a matter of sort of tapping into it and getting them to. Right? Did you get that?
Is that? I don't remember it.
Oh, okay.
But I believe that it's there.
I mean, I guess you could say, yeah, if I've seen it once, it's somewhere in my mind, right? Or or does it really go away? Like, do you really forget things, or are you just unable to recall them?
Maybe.
And what's the difference?
Yeah.
If it's still in your brain, but you can't get to it, is it still really there?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I, you know, memorizing entire texts is something that that is beyond most people, being able to memorize for long-term huge portions of text.
Yep.
But the other thing that underground culture in Fahrenheit 451 reminded me of was back in the early hundreds, as the Roman Empire was being, in Europe anyway, was being toppled by the invasions of the Visigoths and the Goths and the Vandals and the barbarians. All those barbarians were coming in and were destroying the culture.
Yeah.
Raising, places to the ground, burning books, destroying culture of every kind. And then also the Roman culture was sort of imploding from the inside also. It was sort of burning itself up. There arose a movement out of early Christendom. These Benedictine monasteries all sprung up in various places all over Europe. Mm-hmm. And they became the network that preserved all the culture. Because what they did is every time they found any kind of text or any kind of book, whether it was from Greece or Rome or maybe further east, but certainly all around there, they just set themselves to preserving this culture by writing it all down and creating all these books. Mm-hmm. And then they also preserved things like, farming techniques and different ways of preserving and building an actual civilization after the Roman civilization was destroyed by itself and by the invading barbarians.
Right.
So that's kind of what I was reminded of when I read about this little group of ragtag hobos out there on the outskirts of the city, ready to go in and pick up the pieces of this civilization.
Yeah. The same thing happened in A Canticle for Leibowitz. That was a post-apocalyptic society where there were still monks who were preserving books. Mm-hmm. And in our own history, the Nazis burned books. That's commonly known.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that happens when when someone's trying to gain power. You got to get rid of all the knowledge that you don't want people to have.
But I like the fact that in this book, in Fahrenheit 451, there really is a movement out there, and they're just out there. They've been kind of out there waiting for this whole society to burn itself up, and it does. You know,
they just watch from a distance as the entire place gets raised to the ground, right?
Yeah, because war has been brewing this whole time during the book. You know, there are jets flying overhead and the rumors of war. And all of a sudden, they're out there in the encampment many miles from the city. And they watch the rockets come in and demolish the entire city. And they assume that the cities all over the world have been demolished. And so they witness the entire collapse of the civilization in one great big ball of flame. And they know, okay, now is our chance now. And then they head back in knowing that now their task is to rebuild the civilization based on the knowledge that's in their heads. Mm. So I thought that this was a nice dystopia, and that it ends on a of hope, unlike 1984, which ends on a note of absolute despair.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, the last line in 1984 is Winston, broken, completely broken, saying, "I love Big Brother."
Ouch.
But this one, yeah. But Guy Montag, he survives. He gets out, and he's going to be part of the movement to rebuild civilization, which I thought was great. So, by the way, I was when you were talking about the ignorance shaming of your generation.
Yeah,
I was reminded of a book that the title is actually. You're probably going to hate this, but listen to the title of this book. Mm-hmm. It's written by somebody named Mark Bauerlein. It's called The Dumbest Generation. The Digital Age, the subtitle of the book is How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future. Or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30.
Well, why are we the way that we are? Something wasn't passed down, obviously.
Yeah, what is this, an indictment of our educational system?
I don't so much blame my generation for being stupid as I blame the generations before us for not teaching us.
What is it that transforms him from being a lackey of this totalitarian mind-controlling state into an actual rebel? And I don't think there was any one thing that sort of did it, because I think we caught him in the middle of his transformation, actually, at the beginning of the book. Like when he met Clarice, I thought that was so interesting, that little incident of this. He knew her for about a week, just talking to her daily, and discovered how different she was, and then she disappeared. Okay, so that was huge. Mm. And then, you know, he basically tripped over the empty pill bottle on the floor of the bedroom, and his wife had accidentally taken enough pills to kill herself, and he realized, you know, her obliviousness or her perhaps unspoken despair, you know, prompted her to do this. When he went to that one house, the house where he stole the book from.
The woman, ooh.
She would not leave, because most people, when they get caught with all their books, they're like, all right, and they go out so that they don't burn to death with all their books. She did not. She immolated herself with her book. She's the one who actually set the fire by lighting a match. Mm-hmm. And that had a big effect on Montag. And then there was Beatty's speech. Remember back at the firehouse where Beatty knows darn well what Montag has done, that he's stolen a book.
Yeah.
And then Beatty goes all into basically describing, he's speaking as an agent of the state, essentially, about why things are the way they are. We are burning every book that makes even the smallest faction unhappy. You know, anything that makes anyone unhappy, it's going to be gone away. It's done. Disappears. And then he ceases, the culture ceases to engage in any practice that makes anyone unhappy. That's why they don't have funerals anymore, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Funerals just make people unhappy. So we're not going to have those anymore. Your loved one, if they pass away, they're just going to be incinerated in a few minutes and then just move on with your life. Not going to have any memorials or anything like that. No more memory. You have no more memory of anything. And Beatty has this interesting line. I wrote it down. He says, "The home environment can undo a lot that you try to do at school." No, it's the school's function is to make these little conforming automatons, you know, to lockstep in with the culture. And then so they have to watch very carefully the home environment, because you don't want the home environment to undo what the school is trying to do.
Yeah.
Which clearly Clarice's home environment, she was what they call antisocial, which means she was actually a normal person. And I think Beatty also says, we stand against the small tide of those who want to make everyone unhappy with conflicting theory and thought. Mm-hmm. So the conversation with Faber, where Montag says that he thought that maybe books might help with people's chronic unhappiness, that the secret is to bring back books. Do you remember that?
I think so.
And Faber, by the way, for those of you who haven't read the book, he's a former professor of English, and he's a rebel. He's got, you know, plans to try and, you know, stem the tide of this culture. But anyway, he says no, it's not the books themselves. It's not the lack of books themselves that are the reason we're unhappy. Mm-hmm. It's the things that once were in books, he says. And he says that those things could be found in the TV, could be found in the mass media, in the radio plays, in the productions. All those things could be in those visual electronic productions, but they're not, because those things are designed to entertain and numb the mind and to control the populace. So Faber says the things that are missing are, one, quality of information, you know, detail, infinite care in the presentation of information, textured information, and meaningful information. The second thing that's missing is leisure. And by leisure, he doesn't just mean off hours or time off work or free time. He means actual true leisure, meaning the time and the space and perhaps the peacefulness to think and reflect deeply on what you have taken in, on the information that you've taken in. The world in the book is just a constant barrage of sounds and words and images that you can't even think about and process, let alone refute or you know, realize maybe there's something wrong here. You know, there's no way. It just comes at you constantly. And then the third thing that's missing, according to Faber, is the right to carry out actions based on what we learn from the interaction of the first two. So the ability to take in, you know, good information, think about it, and then process it, and then make decisions for your own life based on it, you know? Mm-hmm. And he says, so it's not just the books. It's not burning books. It's burning all information and all thought and all ability to think. There's another quote from the book that struck me. I don't remember who said this. It was either Montag or Faber. He said, those who don't build must burn.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you're not, you know, positively creating something, then you're just going to burn things down.
The book Fahrenheit 451 has a theme that goes through it of obviously fire, burning things going up in flames. And at the end, I think one of the exiles that Montag meets is making a comparison between mankind and the phoenix.
Yeah, I've got that passage right here. Mm-hmm. It's on the second to last page of the book where he says, he's talking about the phoenix.
Yeah.
He says, every time the phoenix burnt himself up, he sprang out of the ashes and was born all over again. And it looks like we're doing the same thing over and over, but we've got one thing the phoenix never had. We know the damn silly thing we just did. We know all the damn silly things we've done for 1,000 years. And as long as we know that and always have it around where we can see it, someday we'll stop making the funeral pyres and jumping in the middle of them.
Hmm.
Well, everybody, that concludes our discussion of Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. Mm-hmm. We will sign off now, and we'll catch you all at the next episode. Thank you so much, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.